Welcome to SaaS Theory Podcast, a place for deep dive conversations, SaaS trends, and strategic talks with SaaS founders and decision makers. Today we're joined by Allo Aago, who's based in Estonia. Allo is the co-founder and CEO of TeamScope, a very interesting SaaS company. TeamScope is creating decision tools for hiring, succession planning, and developing high-performing teams. As Allo says, it's inconceivable for CMOs, for example, to work without growth models, frameworks, and analytics. Then he asks, why are we still relying on gut feeling when hiring people? Listen to our conversation and discover many other crucial insights that will change your mind about hiring. Tere pavast, Allo. Thank you very much for being here.
Tere, Victoria.
I would like to start this interview with this mantling a myth. So my question is, what's a generally accepted rule about hiring that's actually not true?
That's a good one. And I guess there are many. But the one that we hear most often, I think, would be that you can recognize the best candidate right away, that there is some spark in their eye or some magical thing happening in the first minute into an interview where a leader can recognize who is the best person for the job. Now, that's completely wrong. That's, I think, one of the worst misconceptions about hiring that we've heard. There are variations of that going around in different segments. If you follow startups closely, then there seems to be a saying gaining popularity. It goes something like fire fast, or something like that, which in the sense is true that if you do hire fast or without putting too much thought into it, then probably you have to fire fast as well. So in that sense, it's like a true statement, but it's not great advice for most founders. So yeah,
yes,
that would be it, that you can recognize the best candidate right away based on some instinct or something magical happening during the interview.
So we'll talk a bit later about the difference between intuition, gut feeling, and real raw data. Mm. But until then, let me ask you a first question. What's the difference between hiring professionals and hiring leaders?
The main difference is that normally when hiring professionals, it would be a team leader, the head of the function, someone like that hiring. Excuse me for a second. And in that case, they would mostly hire people whose job they have done themselves or whose job they know really well. Meaning that if you're an engineer, after doing that for a few years and becoming really good at it, quite often people are promoted to be head of engineering, who would then have to hire a bunch of other engineers. Meaning that when hiring specialists, people quite often know the job they will be doing. They can evaluate their potential experience, understanding of the job and the function based on their own experience and based on things they have already done. Now, when hiring leaders, by definition, you are hiring someone normally that can do something better than you do. Meaning that when I would look for a CMO, I can't assume that I know more about marketing than they do, and they can't judge their potential expertise, understanding of the industry based on my own knowledge. So it's like Ben Horowitz has a good saying that for most founders, especially hiring executives, is like trying to hire a Japanese translator without knowing any Japanese yourself. So it's kind of either guesswork, or if you have like a methodology, or if you are better prepared, then you can take a lot of guesswork out of it. And I guess that's one of the reasons why you know the saying or myth that you can recognize a good leader right away, why this myth exists. Because if you don't really know what to ask and what to evaluate, then the only thing you can evaluate by definition is kind of likability or intuition, or if you have a good feeling about that person. So, you know, if you don't really know what to ask, then you are ask questions that will generate the feeling, not really give you too many facts that help you make a better judgment.
So yes, we'll come back to Ben Horowitz and his approach to hiring leaders. But first, let's get the definitions right. In your opinion, what makes a good leader?
A generic and boring answer, that it depends. But I think that's actually a really kind of important and profound understanding or definition. It really depends on the job, the organization, the team they will be leading, the situation that your company is in. So, I mean, if you just ask a very generic question, what makes a good leader, then you know, academics who have studied what are the characteristics of a great CEO, then quite often if you ask a really broad question like that, then you will get a really broad answer, meaning that the studies normally find that, you know, good leaders tend to be smart and hardworking, which isn't really too helpful. I mean, it's probably true that yes, most good leaders are smart and hardworking, but in order to really get useful insight into that, then you really must consider the context, the people they will be working with, the situation your business is in, and what you need to accomplish, etc. So it was a long way of saying it depends.
Okay, so in this case, what you're saying is that each CEO has to have their own definition of what a good leader for their company is.
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yes. And well, I guess now, in more recent years, you have probably also noticed that the kind of stereotypical expectations towards even the CEOs, mm-hmm. these have changed a lot. I think tech has helped with that quite a bit. Before the tech industry became really big, the stereotypical kind of expectation of a CEO was somebody, you know, really confident and ambitious and, you know, tall normally, a man normally. So these things all have changed, and also have changed a little bit, must change more when it comes to, you know, heads of or VPs or other C-level roles. So it really does depend. And we would very much encourage people to think about their own context, think about what's the job, meaning what does that person actually need to accomplish, and then start moving from that, not start moving from a kind of stereotypical expectation or understanding of what these people should be like, but actually start deriving these characteristics based on the key objectives and based on the situation these people will be joining.
Okay, and if we go back to what Ben Horowitz said, that CEOs have to hire people who are much better at their jobs than the CEOs at this specific job, because after all, very rarely a CEO knows what it's like to be the head of remote or the head of customer success. So considering this dilemma, like, let's imagine that a CEO has to hire a customer success leader or a marketing leader, and they know very little about this topic, and they don't have direct advisors inside their teams to talk about, like, okay, what do we have? What are we searching for? So for this specific person, what would be your recommendation? How to approach the hiring process?
Well, we always say that start from the key objectives. I mean, that is something probably not many people can help with. I mean, you as a hiring manager should at least figure out why you need to hire that person or why you need a new person. If you don't know that, then it's tricky. If you need to figure out at least that much. And once you have figured out that you need a head of customer success, for example, in order to help you, you know, improve your conversion rates, or in order to guarantee retention of, you know, at least an X percent of users after they start a free trial or test your product, or you need to improve retention of key accounts, or you need to expand key accounts. So you at least need to figure out the basic, you know, 3 to 5 key objectives that a new person should accomplish in order for you to be able to say after 6 or 12 months or 24 months that you're really happy with the results, and that person has been wildly successful in that role. Now, if you can't figure out what are the 3 to 5 key objectives, then indeed it's figuring out the requirements of, or what would that person need to look like or be like. That's close to impossible, or then you again have to revert back to your intuition or gut feeling or kind of a stereotypical understanding of what would a CFO or a COO be like or have to have done, etc. But that's not really helpful probably in your situation. Starting then from that those key objectives, then you would need to figure out what are the things in their past experience, past accomplishments, competencies, capabilities, job-related skills that they need in order to be, to have a reasonably good chance of achieving those objectives. The obvious thing is that if you can find a person who has done it already, meaning that, your key objective is to improve retention rates, you set that as a criteria for hiring, then have a conversation about whether a person has been in a role where their objective was to improve retention rates, how they went about doing that, what was the situation like when they joined, what was the situation like when they left, meaning have they done it before, is kind of the best and most obvious way of doing that. If you can't find a candidate where you would reasonably could assume that they have already done it before, for whatever reason, either you can't just afford that level of seniority, or the candidates simply are not out there, or you can't find them, then find the closest kind of proxy you can think of. What I mean by that is when a requirement would be to open up a new segment, generate new leads, establish connections or a network with people that are hard to reach, then you might think of what's the kind of underlying characteristic that is really necessary in order to be, have the potential to be successful in that, and ask questions about, what's the closest thing a person has done that would help you evaluate whether they can do it again. So either by asking, tell me about the time when you had to get in contact with a person who was really hard to reach. Tell me about the time when you had to set a really ambitious objective for yourself and then work really hard for a long period of time in order to achieve that. And even if they don't have that specific work experience, meaning that they haven't been in a job where they had to improve retention by X amount, then at least find something in their experience where they had to accomplish something similar, where they can tell you in detail how they went about doing that, what was the beginning and what was the outcome, so that you can expect if they would do it again in your situation, they would have a reasonable chance of achieving your goals. So that's roughly it. Figure out what you need. Figure out what's the experience, characteristic, knowledge or skill they would need in order to have a reasonably good chance of getting to that point, and then ask questions about those past experiences in a really methodical manner, digging deeper and deeper into each experience, result, the process, their role in it. So that's it. That's roughly the formula.
Mm-hmm. Very methodical, very specific in details. But if we go back to the notion of what's a good leader, I mean, I've seen companies actually, people are hiring leaders to come up with strategies, to define the actions, but also to train and to inspire their teams to get the results. It's actually, this is the person who is actually is not doing the work itself, like going, changing the websites, increasing the conversion rate, but actually has the sufficient background, the sufficient strategic knowledge and overview that allows him, her, or they to inspire and to train the team to achieve this result.
Absolutely, yes, indeed. I mean, if they have a team to lead, then
yes,
it would be a good characteristic to ask. That, have you onboarded, hired, trained anyone? How did you How did you evaluate how successful these people became? How long did you retain them, etc.? So, indeed, if they have somebody to lead, then it would be a good idea to ask about whether they have been in a leading role before and how that went and what was the outcome of that.
Yeah, so and since we're talking about small companies, usually CEOs are the great leaders at the beginning. They're hiring a customer success rep, sales rep, marketing. They're doing overviewing everything, but after that, they're realizing that there is a need for leaders. So, at which stage do you think companies should start thinking about hiring leaders? Or yeah.
Again, depends on the definition. I mean, if you're lucky and you have co-founders who each have their own area of expertise, depending on how the team is spread, then if you're really lucky, you can get away with just that structure until maybe Series A. If you're not so lucky and you can only manage, let's say, two functions between you and the co-founder, then you need to figure out or find a way to hire more experienced people already, past seed round or even pre-seed in some cases. It really depends on what's your expertise and what are the functions you can reasonably think you're able to cover. Just whenever you can afford it, I would say is the right answer. Whenever you see that you not only in terms of the cash you have in the bank, but also in terms of what your organization can reasonably handle in terms of the people and the layers of leadership. And one of the struggles of that, or one of the risks that at least experienced VCs warn people against, is that if you're not really mature enough as a business or an organization or as a CEO, then hiring too many experienced leaders too early just means that you would have 30 people in the company having meetings with each other, which doesn't really help too much either. So that's the other risk of maybe doing that too early, because indeed managers or leaders, they want somebody to lead, and they will do managerial activities as well. And if it's a
True,
bit
true.
too early to do that, then you should just focus on your client and your product, then it's maybe not the best thing for your business. So yeah,
True.
that was an answer saying nothing, but I guess as late as possible and as early as you really need to.
It's not an answer saying nothing because I'm thinking about the example of Buffer. Their investors were very pushing very heavily on people to hire on the CEO and the CTO to hire more people, to hire more leaders. And after all, they end up firing a big part of the team because it wasn't sustainable. I mean, they were hiring fast, but the processes inside the company were different. And so they went for slow growth. That is actually a different type of mentality in
Indeed, one of
business.
my former bosses in not the previous but the one job before that, he had a good saying that once a company becomes big enough, then you don't really need clients anymore to be busy all the time. So
Yeah,
I think it's very true, and there's a big risk for startups at least.
that should be a logo on everybody's door. And yeah. Now, considering your very methodical approach, let's talk a little bit about designing a good hiring process because I've seen people just posting on LinkedIn a quick note. This is what we're looking for. This is why. Send us your curriculum. We'll check it. We'll have meetings. But actually, what's a good a good quality hiring process.
Well, what we teach or what we coach our clients to do is, well, first of all, going back to the very first step, meaning figuring out really clearly why you need to hire that person, what would they need to accomplish, and then what are the characteristics based on which you can evaluate whether you have found the right person or not. So by that, I do not mean that you should try to come up with as long of a job description as you can think of. So especially when you look at the job ads, you will quite often find ones where it's like 4 pages long of long list of requirements and expectations and formal credentials. It's just not really helpful. I think what normally happens, or how people end up with a list like that, is they either copy it from someplace else, or the HR manager or the recruiter goes to one or two or several leaders and just writes down everything they say and everything they can think of, and ends up with like an unprioritized list of 40 characteristics mixed with hard requirements, nice to have things, aspirational things. So that's not a good way to start the process. A better way to start the process would be to be really concise about the 3 to 5 key objectives of the role, the 3 to 5 characteristics that the candidate really must have in the past experience, in the formal credentials, in terms of their leadership qualities, in terms of their past track record, that you need to evaluate whether in order to understand when you have found the right person, and to kick off the process only then, only once you have figured out the basic steps. The risk of starting earlier is that, again, coming back to the original discussion, when leaders haven't really, or the hiring manager hasn't really taken the time to figure out what it is they need and what it is they should evaluate people against, it actually quite often happens. And even our executive search partners often say that, you know, they can't simply get the time from the hiring manager that is needed in order to go into a lot of detail about the role, the requirements, you know, past experience, the expectations. People just are busy, and for some reason it's a habit to delegate hiring to the HR manager or the HR business partner, who, I mean, they don't know. It's only the business leader who knows what they need to accomplish as a business. It can't be your talent partner if you don't tell them what specifically you need. So quite often what happens is that if the business leader hasn't really taken the time to think things through, they start with a list of requirements, copy-pasted from the old job ad, or that the HR manager just, you know, got through a 15-minute conversation with different stakeholders, then that situation, in the end, it's still, people still get to a shortlist and people still start interviewing candidates. But if by that time people haven't really thought about what it is they're evaluating in candidates, then, you know, they'll just have a chat and, you know, ask maybe some questions about the past experience. But in many cases, they'll just, you know, talk about themselves and look at candidates nodding or asking good questions about, you know, the experience of the company or the manager, and they'll make an intuitive decision, which, again, it doesn't really lead to good outcomes unless you have put in the work into the very first stage, meaning figuring out what you need and what are the things you need to evaluate in a person in order to understand if you are there or not. So that's the first step. The second steps then, again, depends a bit on the role, how many steps you want to have and what they should be. For more technical roles, quite often you want to do, you know, work sample. If you're hiring a designer, then it would be a good idea to look at the designs they have done before you go into more elaborate methods of evaluation. If it's a very junior hire where you don't really have any experience to evaluate, then things like, you know, some tests or cognitive ability even can help. But for senior hires, mostly you would have interviews, reference checks, and maybe also a work sample if it is appropriate. But in most cases, in at least our segment, it really isn't, or there isn't a small enough piece that give you a good enough understanding of their capabilities. So that was a long way of saying, for leadership roles, you would have interviews mostly, and hopefully reference checks. But both of these, in order to be any good, have to be done well, based on, again, the first step, where you had to outline the characteristics you're actually evaluating during the interview. And then the interview should be really focused, fact-finding missions against the characteristics that you defined were relevant.
And since you mentioned it, the HR professionals, there are plenty of companies delegating the hiring process, but also they're sometimes delegating the process of hiring leaders to HR professionals and to the headhunters. What's your take on that?
Well, we work very closely with headhunters, and they do a wonderful job. It's a really, really tough job, and one that requires a a tremendous or really detailed understanding of the client, their industry, the business where they're at, what they need to accomplish. So it is a really challenging and tough job, and there are people who do that extremely well. So if you have found a good headhunter, then it's quite often, you know, like finding a good lawyer, that you will quite often build a lifelong relationship with them. When the problem with that, obviously, is that it's somewhat of an undifferentiated market. It's not that bad in Europe, and in more established markets like UK and specifically London, where people have a reputation and they have to work really hard and long in order to earn that. But in some larger markets, you know, anyone can pop up tomorrow and establish a headhunting firm. And you know, we do have stories even. We heard a story where a pretty successful group of headhunters was established so that they got like a pitch deck of another executive search firm. They sent it to a freelance designer and asked to change the logo, change, you know, the colors, change the name, and, you know, move around pieces here and there, and then took that pitch deck and started sending it around to different enterprise clients. So that's how they got started. That's how they landed the first client, and, you know, got started with the business. So, you know, in that case, I can't. There is a role for that service, but not probably what people would imagine a headhunter or an executive search professional would do and should do. So, that was a long way of saying that that some do an amazing job, but it's quite often hard for the end user to figure out how to evaluate your headhunter. So how to choose your headhunter is quite often as difficult as choosing between candidates.
Yeah, it's like searching for a leader, basically, is the same.
Exactly, exactly.
And now going to what you're doing, because obviously this incredible amount of knowledge and detail comes from the work you're doing, and you're the co-founder and CEO at TeamScope, and actually this is what you're doing. You're developing models and scientific approach to hiring leaders. And I would like to tell us if you could tell us a little bit more about TeamScope.
Indeed. So, first of all, you know, my background is not in HR, it's not in hiring or talent management. My background is actually mostly in engineering, or specifically in data analytics, business intelligence, data visualization. This is what I used to do before we started TeamScope. And the story or the idea actually came from a discussion I had with my co-founder over Christmas dinner. So a few years back, I was building up a team of data analysts for a pharmaceutical business in our region. For the first time in my career, I had to hire a few people. I had to build up a new team, so I had to make sure, or at least try to figure out what kind of people I need in order to build an effective team and, you know, have a good chance of people working effectively together before they've had that experience. So we had a discussion about that with my co-founder, who also happens to be my uncle. He has been in executive search for roughly 30 years. He established the first executive search and advisory business in the beginning of the 90s. So probably, or actually literally invented the industry in Estonia, at least, or in our region, and then built that business to be the leading executive search office in the Baltics, with some branches in Nordics as well. So anyway, really experienced in executive search and hiring. So when I asked him for advice regarding what are the tools I, as a young hiring manager, can use in order to be a bit better at hiring, and in order to try to figure out, you know, who has the potential to work well with me or the other team members, then Tonis, my co-founder, said that, you know, this is kind of a small lie that I've been telling my clients for 30 years, that they have like this secret toolkit for figuring all that stuff out. But if I'm honest with you, then there really isn't anything I would recommend or anything I would think would be particularly helpful to you as a hiring manager. Now, what he meant by that is that not that there are no tools out there. There's hundreds or thousands of tools that aim to measure some characteristics of a person or predict some outcome or categorize or kind of put a numerical value on some characteristics of a person. But the problems mostly with these tools are that they are designed at best, if they measure anything reasonable at all, then they are designed to be understandable and useful only to a very experienced HR professional at best, who is certified in a particular method, can make sense of, a 10 pages long report and synthesize the 3 to 5 key characteristics that are relevant in that report to something actionable and useful that you can use for interviewing and having a better conversation. But the tools are not really meant for or useful for the person who actually has to make the decision, meaning the hiring manager, who is at best simply overwhelmed and confused by that product or the report. At worst, kind of finds more bias from that product. So that's actually what often happens, is that people have a first impression, and then whatever product you give them, they would just look for proof that would reinforce the first impression from that data or from that that report. So, but when you think about what's the toolkit for a hiring manager, for a VP or something, for a C level something something, what's the toolkit they use for hiring, for building out their team, for thinking of succession, for thinking about development? Then the toolkit is sending resumes back and forth via email, printing them out, and then drawing pictures and notes on it while you have an interview. And after having 6 or 7 interview rounds with 5 candidates, then trying to kind of remember all of that and trying to make sense of the kind of thing you scribbled on paper during these interviews. So that's the toolkit. Now, obviously, that's not a great way of figuring out a really complicated question. Unfortunately, the tools that should be helpful in that process quite often create more confusion and don't really add more clarity, and it's just, for us, seems ridiculous. Why is it that for such an important decision that is so impactful for your business and really complicated for anyone to handle, both emotionally and in terms of the amount of data you simply need to digest and make sense of, why is it that we haven't provided a tool for managers for going through that complicated process? What I mean by that is that if you would ask a CMO, what's your toolkit or methodology or process for budget allocation, for figuring out what's the best channel, or for figuring out what's the best message for your product, then it would sound ridiculous if that CMO would say that, no, I don't really have a toolkit, or I have an intuition, or I don't really look at anything in particular. No, it's not like that. They have really clear data, clear tools, and a clear process for making these complicated decisions. So there should be also one for hiring. And what I mean by that, not the administration of the hiring process. Again, there are thousands or tens of thousands of really good tools for that purpose, but none that would address the quality of the outcome, meaning the quality of the decision, not as much as the administration of the process.
So what are exactly those tools that you developed at TeamScope?
So what we try to, or what we have combined, is the basic process that you would read from the works of Daniel Kahneman, for example. Mm-hmm. So people who have looked into how people make decisions, how they should make decisions in order to get better outcomes. And more specifically, Daniel Kahneman actually has written a lot about hiring as well. And actually the first work or longer experience that he wrote about was redesigning or analyzing the hiring process at the Israeli army, or more specifically how they decided who should move forward to officer training. So what was the process, the decision criteria, and how that was correlated with the outcomes. So Our first inspiration is Daniel Kahneman's work in that. So broadly speaking, decision science, you would call it, and specifically how that then manifested in the work that he did with the Israeli army recruitment process, and how he described the thinking and outcomes of that. And secondly, we do rely a little bit on what you would call more structured evaluation or people analytics tools, basically different tests or surveys or ranking exercises that would help you not put a numerical value definitely on some characteristics, but at least, you know, try to better understand or quantify some aspects that otherwise would be hard to define or make sense of. What I mean by that is things like, you know, leadership competencies that a person feels they're strong at, what are the behavioral characteristics that come naturally to them, what are the situations they feel comfortable in, what are the situations they would rather avoid or that take a lot of energy from them, what's the core kind of motivation behind that person, how they make important decisions. So there are pretty good tools for measuring or at least getting a better understanding of those characteristics through academic surveys or tests or ranking exercises that can be really helpful if used in the right way in the hiring process. So the tools that we are then building is, first of all, a structured process around hiring that would force people to be a bit more methodical, a bit more organized in how they evaluate candidates, figure out what they need, make the final decision, and then combining that process with data analytics where it is helpful, and it is especially helpful in helping people be more deliberate about evaluating things like fit into the team or values alignment or culture add or stuff like that, that otherwise would be just a phrase and people would have to, you know, figure out what it means on their own. There, having more data and having a more methodical approach is really critical and can be helpful if used in the right way. So that was a long way of saying that we help people, first of all, figure out the right process they should go through when thinking about the role, thinking about what's working well in their team, thinking about what are the things they would like to change, therefore what are the things they need to evaluate in candidates. Then, based on that, the platform provides clear evaluation guides and interviewing guidelines for the manager in order to be more specific about what are the things they evaluate and how they evaluate that. And in the end, all of that is summarized basically as a scorecard, or what we would say is a more structured tool for making the final decision than you would normally get.
That's impressive, and actually that's a huge realization for me, because I know the work of Kahneman and Tversky and the behavioral economics. And yes, we say that, okay, people are irrational when they're making economic decisions. But I never thought that actually, yeah, that's true. When hiring somebody, mostly people go with the gut feeling, with the intuition. Mm. Again, it's about irrational behavior. Mm. So that's very interesting. I didn't know that he has studies regarding hiring.
Yeah, he actually, that was a pretty long paragraph in the first book, and actually even described in more detail in now the second book that just came out. Just to summarize the findings, that was actually really interesting, is that when he joined the Israeli army recruitment team as a young economist, then the first thing they did was try to figure out or evaluate existing hiring process where really experienced army recruiters were looking at young recruits and trying to figure out whether they are a good fit for officer training. There was a really elaborate process for doing that, with like team exercises and, you know, physical exercises where they had to climb over each other and climb over a wall, and then like the evaluator, then the interviewer or recruiter, they were, you know, looking at the person and, you know, looking at specific characteristics of them and trying to draw parallels about people they have seen before, etc., etc. And in the end, they kind of ended up with a decision, either, you know, recommend or not recommend, or like a numerical outcome of, you know, 4 out of 5. When they looked at how well that outcome is correlated, or that prediction, that score is correlated with actual outcomes during the officer training or after the officer training, then correlation was not zero, but close to zero. So it was just basically as good as flipping a coin. Although the process was really, really, really detailed, the army recruiters were absolutely experienced professionals in their field, and the job was in that sense standardized, meaning that, I mean, they had been recruiting for the same position for many years or decades. Now, the first thing, as Daniel Kahneman explained, was the first thing they did was they figured out like the seven characteristics of a good officer. So as I said, that don't try to develop a broad impression or a broad understanding, but kind of drill down into seven things. So what are the seven characteristics that a good officer should have? And then they kind of specified those seven characteristics so they would be clear, they would be more measurable than a kind of generic impression, so that it would be defined clearly enough that different people who would read that definition would get a roughly similar understanding of what it means. So something like methodical or let's say organized manner of working. So that might be a characteristic. So organized manner of working with a more specific definition of what it actually means and how you would evaluate that. So they figured out the seven characteristics of what a good officer would be like. They forced all the army recruiters to rate candidates one by one characteristic at a time. So to drill down into these seven characteristics, put a numerical value on it, and then use that rating to judge who should go into officer training or not. And they saw that this scorecard of seven parameters very strongly outperformed the intuitive impression or the generic feeling of the army recruiter. What was interesting was that the next iteration of the process was actually, it didn't came from like an economical thinking of what should be the next step, but as Daniel Kahneman explained, then recruiters started complaining that they will be turned into robots and they need more freedom in their job. They just can't, they are more capable of just filling in a scorecard of seven characteristics. So what then Daniel Kahneman changed in the process was that they were not forced to just summarize or take the average of these seven, but they were told that rate people based on these seven characteristics, then look at the scorecard, close your eyes, and put a final mark. So looking at, a person who has these seven characteristics, how likely do you think it is that they will be a really good army officer? And then put your mark based on not the summary, but based on, closing your eyes, thinking about these seven characteristics, and then deciding. And that strongly outperformed the, let's say, average rating or the prediction based on the average. So there is room for your intuition, and your intuition, let's say, is really helpful. But at least based on his experiment, it was only helpful after people had gone through that more structured process, developed a clear understanding of individual data points, and then after that understanding, developed their intuitive understanding. So that was a really interesting read for us, and actually inspired a lot of our process and a lot of our thinking about it as well.
Yeah, because after all, what's professional intuition? Professional intuition is based on the knowledge and expertise and all the years you've accumulated doing your work. It's nothing, it's nothing woo, it's nothing weird, it's nothing, it's factual.
Exactly, yes, exactly. Yeah. But that's a really important thing that you said there, that it's an accumulation of your experience. Yeah, so you have done something 100 times and then your intuition takes over and it becomes easier the next time you do that. So, driving a car or catching a ball or something like that. You don't really have to put a lot of thought into that. But the critical difference there is that, intuition is useful if you have done it before many times.
Yeah.
So if you haven't hired a CMO before and you can't, rely on your past experience of failed and good CMO hires, then, it's not very useful. It's just you haven't trained your intuition in that particular area.
Yeah, and obviously Ben Horowitz has a huge intuition after hiring
yes.
so many people.
Indeed, he does. Yeah. And, if you could ask Ben Horowitz, is that a good person to be my CMO? Then I would trust them, their opinion. But if you can't, then you need to, I would recommend being, having a bit structure around it to replace your maybe gut feeling, or at least add to that.
And if we move away from this extremely methodical, and I absolutely love your approach, but there are so many companies that don't know about TeamScope and what you're doing, and they're using tests, personality tests, like Myers-Briggs personality types, and they're hiring based on these tests. Like I took this test several times, and actually the 16 personality tests several times. All these times I had different answers, different results, depending on the stage where I was. So how, I mean, what's your take on that? Should people rely on this test? Should they hire based on whether someone is an introvert or an extrovert?
Again, the answer is it depends. I mean, there are good tests and bad tests. We also use some tests in our process, and one specifically for personality characteristics. We don't use the 16 PFO MBTIs. I mean, they should not be. Even the authors of these tools would say that they're not designed for that purpose and should not be interpreted or used in that way. They are, unfortunately, yes, and they are used in that way. So one problem is that obviously whatever you're testing, then it should be, the test should be reliable enough so that if you take the same test tomorrow, then you would not get dramatically different responses. So it should be more or less stable, at least, day after day or week after week. Many are not, but I mean, that's kind of very basic to figure out if your test that you intend to use, if they have at least the reliability data to back it, and some third-party research to justify how and where it should be used. An even bigger problem, I would say, is that quite often people haven't really don't really know what it is they are testing and what's the desired outcome. Is it relevant for the job or not? Should I look for, that category of a person? And if they're not that category, then is it actually predictive of the outcome in that particular environment and that particular job? So again, some data points can be really useful. And how we have built these data points into our product, for example, is that we use one of the elements we use and encourage people to go through is analyzing their existing team to understand if they have a healthy level of diversity when it comes to these behavioral patterns, thinking styles. And if they don't, then again, not take that as just a an algorithmic decision, but you just think about whether it's actually holding back their performance and if they would benefit from adding a bit more diversity to the team. So a practical example is that if we go through that process with our team and we do notice that, we tend to be really analytical and introverted mostly as a group, then indeed it is a characteristic. So one parameter that I would see is favorable in when choosing between many candidates. If we can onboard somebody who is, much more extroverted, can bring more lively energy into the conversations, can encourage us to network better, et cetera, et cetera. So that might be a beneficial characteristics that I would consider that would add one plus or, one bonus point to the scorecard that I'm thinking of. So if used well, there is reason, or there is they can actually help people think about characteristics that are really relevant, that would really help improve their team dynamic, team performance, performance as a group, and that would also help to overcome your intrinsic bias of naturally favoring people that are similar to yourself. So I mean, if you don't have a clear understanding of what you're looking for, then naturally you are more pulled towards people that are close to you, both in terms of, how they look and behave and what their personality characteristics are. But it's more helpful or more useful for a team to have a healthy level of diversity in that. So using tests in a way to understand where are your potential gaps and, what's the thing that might be holding back your performance and where you might benefit from complementing the team in one or the other characteristic. And then using that as one data point for not ranking or not scoring candidates, but filling in your scorecard, having a more meaningful conversation with candidates about that particular dynamic or behavior or past experience, these can be really helpful. But obviously, they're only helpful if you use the right tests that actually measure things that, you know, exist and matter. If you use them in a way that is, you're a bit conscious about it, meaning that you know what you expect, why you think that trait or characteristic is desirable, and you know what part of your decision-making matrix this will make up, and then you actually use it for that purpose, meaning that you don't read too much into the data, meaning you don't like just what often happens with tools if used in a not very deliberate manner is that if people don't know what they're looking for in a report, then they would, as I said, they would look for some characteristics that would reinforce their first impression, or quite often they would read too much into the data and just find some random data point that might not be relevant at all, and you know, draw a judgment based on that. A good example was that we heard from one of our partners, a headhunter who was struggling with a client before we onboarded them, and the client was using a similar tool like an MBTI or something like that, and didn't really know why they use it or what they're actually looking for in that report, but you know, just out of habit they did anyway for all candidates. And then they got a response or a result of a person that scored, you know, whatever, in the 63rd percentile in something, and the hiring manager then, based on that one data point, concluded and told the headhunter that, yeah, I have to leave out this person because, you know, they scored 63 in that. And I also had one other person who scored a 63 in that. And you know, we had a terrible relationship and, you know, didn't get along at all. And they sucked at their job. So I can't hire that person. So you're just getting stuck on, you know, looking for one data point, one, you know, percentage, drawing parallels to some random event in the past that might not be related to that 63rd percentile at all. So that's a really bad way of using these tools. There is a good way, but it's not as simple as just, you know, getting a person to fill the test and reading the report and then, you know, just looking for a sentence that kind of you feel is relevant. So it should be a more deliberate process.
There should be a balance.
Yes, there should be a balance first, and there is a good way of using the insight, and there is a really bad way of using that insight.
So from what you're telling me, I understand that you're drinking your own champagne and you use TeamScope for hiring.
Indeed.
But still, I have a curiosity. If looking back at your experience, if you have any hiring decisions that went wrong, like you thought hired the right person, but...
many. So we have several. when we do, obviously, we analyze the reasons. If something goes wrong, then we go back... to understand what was the process, why we made that decision, what was the reasoning at the time, what could we have done differently. And one kind of rule of thumb that I've noticed is that roughly our success rate is 80-20, meaning in some cases it's like 80-20 the other way around, that we, you know, 80% of the decisions we made were really bad or complete disasters. And when looking back at what's the common characteristic of the decisions that I'm really happy about now, where I can say that we got it right, you know, roughly 80% of the time, versus what are the characteristics of the process or the situation where we were in when we got it wrong, you know, most of the time, 80% of time even. Then in situations where we were either really emotional for whatever reason, that, you know, the company was stuck in a specific place, or we just for whatever reason somebody recommended someone else who we did not plan to hire before, but, you know, since it appeared that a really good person is available and we have to move fast, and, you know, otherwise we lose the opportunity, or we just, you know, for whatever reason we didn't have a process, we just had, you know, one person. We conduct interviews and have a conversation and do something, but in many cases, at least in the beginning, more so than now, we kind of forgot about the process and just, you know, made a decision based on a couple of conversations or somebody's recommendation, it was almost always a terrible decision. So I would say that 80% wrong, 20% 20% right. So there is actually one particular success that I can think of that came from that process, that somebody recommended, we had a good conversation, made a quick decision, it turned out well. The situations where we have actually conducted the process, meaning that we have decided that we need, you know, that person for that job, they should accomplish these things, these are the things we should evaluate, and we had, you know, multiple candidates to choose from, in those cases we have gotten it roughly 80% right.
So your process actually helps teams to find also people who are culturally fit, right?
Yes, although I think the term is it's become a really loaded term now.
Mm.
So, I mean, people use the phrase culture fit in very different ways. You know, some people ask about hobbies to understand or evaluate that. Some people say that you should go out for beer in order to figure out if a person is a good culture fit or not, or, you know, you should put them into an uncomfortable situation, or, you know, there is a sort of myth around it, and again, it's now become a loaded term that has a lot of, in some cases, bias in it, et cetera, et cetera. So we don't say culture fit, but we say that they should be a good addition to your team, in the sense that it's better or easier, and you have a much, much higher success rate if you work with people that share similar core values to yourself, meaning that, you know, it creates this foundation of trust. You can be sure that if put into a tight position, that person roughly would make a similar decision or kind of have the same basic principles based on which they would make the decision as you would, which kind of generates this trust and like a feeling of cohesiveness in a team that's really helpful. At the same time, culture fit should not mean that you hire from the same school that you went to, or, you know, people who have the same hobbies, or in many cases we hear hiring managers asking about what books do they read, and then if they read the same books, then, you know, they're a good fit with the team. I think that's a terrible idea, because, I mean, then you just have people who have the same experiences and you know, read the same books and see the same things. That's just really boring and not really helpful for business. So culture fit in the sense that, yes, our product helps people evaluate how well aligned they are in terms of the core values of a person, and then in everything else, in terms of the competencies, personality traits, etc., it kind of nudges people to look for diversity, not fit.
That's an interesting take, because, for example, Johnny Wolfhard had the CEO at Hopin. He says that he's hiring people based on their ego. He's trying to identify people who have low ego. And Andrei Husid, the CEO at Miro, he's saying that he's trying to find humble people to be culturally fit. So,
Indeed, that might be a characteristic of their culture. If Hopin has, as you said, more humble leaders, and they like that and want to maintain that, then it makes sense to evaluate that in a person. You know, ask a question about whether, you know, tell me about the time when you let somebody else take credit for your accomplishments, or tell me about the time when you shared your accomplishments with the team. So it makes complete sense, and actually that's how, you know, humility is one parameter that we do measure. We do see some outliers. To be honest, that's not a common core element of culture that we would see, but we do see some outliers. And then indeed the product encourages people to think about whether that's an important characteristic of their culture. Do they want to maintain that? And therefore, what's the thing they should ask a candidate in order to understand if they are likely to share that mindset or not?
Now, we've discussed about hiring from a company's perspective, but also let's look a little bit at the candidates. And my question is, how do you make your company attractive for leadership candidates? And what are actually people looking right now when they're searching for a job in a leadership position?
Indeed, that is a small struggle for us as well. What we have not done well is that we're simply not very well known in where we are located, meaning that the headquarters is based out of Estonia. Most of our clients are in London or the US. So we never kind of thought that it was important that we are well known here. So that's something that I can't say that I know much about, and I haven't done well myself, meaning being known, just name familiarity, and then establishing a reputation of being a good place to work, and a growing business. That's something that other people can tell you more about. What we do know, and what we would strongly recommend, is focusing on the opportunity in your job ad, or however you reach out to a candidate. And well, in these situations, you're looking for an ambitious person who is looking for a, first of all, a leap forward in their career and a way to accomplish something. So a really good way is to talk about the accomplishments or the specific things they can do at your business that they can't do elsewhere, why you offer that unique opportunity to them, and talk about it in a way that is challenging, meaning that the focus on the challenge, and don't focus so much on the kombucha or the nice office or something like that. So high performers should not be attracted to that. High performers are attracted to the opportunity of taking a leap forward, challenging themselves, achieving something that is difficult and helps them personally advance and your business advance. So I think that's a really good way. Structure your outreach by highlighting what's the unique opportunity they will have in your business, why that is challenging, what do they need to accomplish in order to be successful. And that's it. That we have seen is a really good way of improving your response rates and getting the right people excited.
But still, you'd say that being known, it's important.
For sure. Yeah, that's something we are struggling with now, that when we talk to candidates, quite often people say that, yeah, it's like remarkable that you're working with such big name clients, and you have actually achieved so much, but I haven't heard about you before. So that's something we haven't done well, and I have to improve.
Now, according to your data on the website, correct me if I'm wrong, 60% of executives say the biggest challenge when starting a new position is understanding the culture and the team. So, having this in mind, my question is, how should companies approach onboarding the leaders and to help them actually understand the culture and the team?
Well, that's onboarding more broadly. That's a really long topic, and I hope that people have covered the basics. I hope that people understand by now, or most people understand by now, that onboarding is not about showing where the bathroom is and how to operate the coffee machine, and what's the where can they find the instructions for fire safety and all of that. I have actually gone through an onboarding process like that. They literally, the HR manager took my hand and walked me around the office and showed me where the bathroom is located, and then gave me a manual of fire safety and stuff like that to read through in my first day.
And that's it,
And
onboarded.
that's
Hello is
it. I was
onboarded.
stuck there
Yeah.
behind my desk reading fire safety manuals. So that's a really good way to ruin the first impression and basically lose out on a good
Yeah.
candidate. Most decisions to leave actually are made in the first couple of weeks on the job. So make sure that the first 2 weeks are planned well in advance, that the person you are onboarding not only understands where the bathroom is. I think people can figure it out quite quickly,
And
but
if you're remote, you just go home
yeah,
outside of your
exactly.
office.
But what's more important is that being really clear about what you expect of them in the first day, the first week, the first month, and the first kind of 3 months or year on the job. Like, that's the basic. Like, figure out what they actually should be doing and accomplishing in the first days. Figure out who are the people they should meet. Make sure that they are available and their calendar is free or booked for those conversations, and kind of be very clear about it. End up with a really clear onboarding process. Do the legwork before the person joins. good example we had was that in the beginning I told you about the our methodology of forcing people to think through what are the 3 to 5 things a new hire should accomplish in order for you to be able to say they have been really successful. We did that exercise with a hiring manager. So they were quite detailed and specified clear goals for the first month, 3 months, and 12 months. So they did it really well. What they did with that after hiring was copy-paste the same exact bullet points and gave it to a candidate during onboarding and said, listen, you know, that's your job. This is what I expect of you. And that same manager has reminded me several times that that's by far the best kind of hiring process they went through. And the candidate was so happy with the onboarding experience that they, you know, they had complete clarity about what's expected of them, how should they spend their time, what they should be doing. So, and that's one part. Be really clear about what you expect of a person. Do the work and don't expect your HR team to do that work for you. They can't. I mean, they're not running your department or business. They can't know what that person should accomplish in the first month for you to be happy. You have to figure out and write it down and translate that clearly. And the other element of you know, onboarding to the team or onboarding to the culture is that's something also that we train people to do through our product as well. That, you know, after going through that methodical process of analyzing their team, figuring out the characteristics they hold dear, meaning what are the things in their team they would really like to maintain when scaling or hiring more people, just be really explicit and clear about it. So what our platform does actually compares the team and the candidate when they are onboarded. It opens up that data to all parties and tells the candidate that, you know, come in and compare yourself and your expectations and your characteristics with the rest of the team and have a conversation around the data points where you see that there might be misalignment or where you're not naturally kind of on the same page. It's critical that then kind of just make your expectations explicit and have a conversation around it. So if, for example, hoping would really favor humility, then it makes sense to analyze that characteristic in a person. If you're not naturally aligned in that characteristic, in humility, yeah, it's not necessarily a deal breaker, but at least you should make that really clear and explicit and have that conversation in the early days, just to avoid misunderstandings and kind of miscommunication. That's the main reason for that anxiety and the reason why things go wrong. People just don't make it clear enough that you would assume that other people care about the same things that I do, but you know they don't. They are, it's a different person. You can't assume that. it's something you should just be very clear about. So what we do and then is that obviously again we use our own product. When we onboard a new person, then we open up our team. We explain that, listen, these are the core values that we care about. These are the things where we are kind of aligned, so they're really important to us. In our case, it's things like creative freedom, autonomy, ambition. So we then explain what it means to us, how that manifests in the way we work together, in our behavior, and why we expect the same, or we at least want the person to be able to adjust to that environment and expectations. So for example, taking the same autonomy, we explain that, you know, this is a characteristic that you see is really important to most of the team. What it means is that we are not very strict about how you should structure your work, when you should show up to the office, what you should focus your time on. Obviously, it doesn't mean that we're not clear about the goals. We're really clear about the objectives. We really outline them very clearly. But then, you know, we expect to have the freedom to work on our own time, set our own priorities. We don't really expect others to ask, you know, why did you show up 30 minutes late today? We don't really, that's not why we are here and why we're building the company. And we would expect you to kind of have the same mindset. You have clear goals, but, you know, you have to be mature and an adult about how you structure your work. You know, it's your responsibility. We expect you to take that responsibility on yourself. And, you know, that's how we can work together effectively. So just being really clear about it, setting your expectations in advance, just reduces that anxiety dramatically. And it's just unfair to assume that people can figure it out on their own. It's unreasonable to assume that you are naturally aligned in everything, and it's just, you know, bad management to not make that explicit.
Yeah, and this is what the head of remote at GitLab, I forgot his name, he was saying that he's obsessed with searching for everything implicit and making it explicit to make sure that everybody understands what they have to do. They have this clarity, which is,
Exactly. Yeah,
yeah,
that's the job.
especially in a remote world, it's this is the most difficult thing to do. And since we're discussing a little bit about Hopin and the remote world, I mean, you know that Hopin is the fastest growing startup in the history. With in 2 years, they reached an almost to 8 billion valuation. But the beauty of this company is that they don't have actually an office. The CEO is a digital nomad himself, and they hired more than 600 people remotely. And
Oh, wow.
obviously, they hired their leaders remotely too. So what's your take on that? How do you hire a leader remotely? And can you use a Teamscope process to hire somebody, a leader, remotely?
Indeed, for us it was in that sense lucky that we did get a small boost from the COVID crisis, in the sense that it seemed for most organizations it seemed impossible to hire a C-level leader remotely before, you know, they were forced to do that. Some of our clients were forced to hire a new CEO remotely. They onboarded the new CEO, had to start, you know, work for 3 to 6 months before meeting anyone really face to face. So having that kind of forced upon organizations made many of them realize that if their methodology, yeah, so to say, their method for hiring leaders before was to meet a person, you know, go out for dinner and have 7 rounds of interviews and try to, you know, get this feeling about the person, then if you can't do that anymore, then what's the alternative? You know, what's your methodology or process then? So they started looking for one. Luckily, many found us. And indeed, well, the answer is the same. I'm like a broken record saying that, you know, figure out what you're looking for, be methodical about evaluating that, and just, you know, decide based on those characteristics. That's it. That's what they then figured out. I mean, culture fit or evaluating team fit remotely, again, you can do that, but you can't do that based on a hunch or, you know, based on meeting a person, shaking their hand, and then trying to figure out, you know, if they're the right person or not. So it is possible, but again, the answer is again being a bit more methodical and deliberate in how you do that.
I have a question. I asked you this once, but I want to for you to reply in our podcast. Would you hire a leader that has a side hustle? Because there are so many people having side hustles and micro projects and micro SaaS and.
Yes, I just yesterday I said no to a candidate that otherwise was had an amazing track record, just like a 10 out of 10 in terms of the experience and the reputation and the companies they have worked in. I said no because they have a side hustle that they did not want to give up. The reason for that is quite simple. I mean, side hustles are fine for junior level roles, for maybe specialist roles, for some roles where you don't really need, or where you don't have so much to do for a really talented specialist to fill their time and kind of be engaging and motivating enough. So for example, I'm really happy with our designer. He's probably the best designer we can think of or find in our region. But you know, the business is still too small that we can't possibly keep him engaged day after day. So it's fine that you know, he is a contractor and works with many businesses at the same time. Now for leaders, and specifically, you know, C-level or head of something, I would never consider a person who has a side hustle, just because, first of all, building a startup it takes takes like superhuman effort from everyone. Not in terms of, I'm not saying that you have to work 20-hour days. That's just not doable for a really long time. But in terms of the mental energy, the focus, the emotional toll it takes on you, it takes a really, really superhuman effort. The smartest people in the world, the smartest and most hardworking people in the world that you can think of, like, you know, people like Ben Horowitz or Marc Andreessen, who have built many businesses from the ground up that have really been impactful. These are some of the smartest, most hardworking people that you can think of. And I mean, I would challenge you to find one. Okay, there is one. There is one, which is Elon Musk, who has two jobs.
Yeah. And he's tweeting. I don't know how he has the time.
So that's one exception out of what, like 7 billion people. And other than that, I do not know any founder stories where somebody would tell me that, yeah, I built this amazing business and you know, I had this side hustle or I was doing it part-time. And it just doesn't, it's very unlikely that it would be possible. If you find someone like Elon Musk, then it might be possible, but I mean, it's very unlikely that a person with that level of capability and ambition would want to be employed by you. And so it's very unlikely that that you would find such a person who can manage that toll.
Yeah, focus on one thing and do it well.
Yes, at least in the early stages of a business. I mean, fine, if your startup is already 1,000 people and you have like a minor department or a small region that you need somebody to manage, and they have like a florist business as a side hustle, that might be fine. But if you're like a 10-person company and your head of sales is part-time, then it's just you're just reducing your chances of success so dramatically. I mean, I wouldn't take that risk.
Okay, I wanted to have you on the record saying that, because this is a challenge, considering that almost everybody has a side hustle today. So
And indeed, it's really painful. And as I said, you know, saying no yesterday was really painful.
I can see your pain in your eyes when you said
indeed.
It.
We don't have, like, to be honest, we don't have an alternative. It wasn't like, you know, we said no to one out of seven, but I said no to one candidate that we had. The risk that I want to avoid with that is that I wouldn't say that the biggest risk for a founder or a leader is hiring the wrong person or making a terrible hiring decision. I mean, if you have any kind of self-reflection capabilities and any honesty about your own decisions and your own actions, then you can kind of figure out that it's a terrible decision quite quickly. Yeah. So if it really doesn't work out, the results are not there, your relationship isn't there, I mean, you can manage or at least decide that it was a bad decision and do something about it. Much worse problem is that if you make a mediocre decision and it's not bad enough for you to take action, but not good enough to move you forward. And, you know, especially true for C-level or for leadership roles, where you have like, you know, you only have one CMO, don't you? You only have one chance and one person there. If someone who is half committed, even if they're really smart and capable, if someone who is half committed fills the position, then, I mean, that's it. you can't hire somebody else if it's not so bad that you would let them go. Then you're kind of stuck, and that's it. You know, that can be detrimental for your business. So I would say that it's even a bigger risk in the early stages than making a terrible decision.
Got it. Now, finally, I wanted to ask you, what are your predictions for hiring, and especially for the SaaS industry in terms of hiring leaders? What do you think we will see in the next years?
Well, what we predict will happen, and the reason why we are still building what we are building, is that in a few years, hopefully, you know, not 10, but maybe 3 or 5 years, that in a few years, at least for more modern, forward-thinking organizations, it should be ridiculous for a leader to say, when you would ask, you know, what's the tool or method you used for that hiring decision, if they would say something like, oh no, I have a hunch about that person, or you know, they came recommended and you know, I have a good feeling about that person. In 3 to 5 years, they should have a clear answer, meaning that you know, this is what we evaluated, these are the data points based on which I think it's a good decision. You know, this is the process that I went through, this is the tool that I used, and that's it. So our prediction, and well, that's the future that we're working towards, and every day making good progress, is that that's how it will be. So that if you would ask, like, if you would have asked a salesperson 10 years ago, if you're using a CRM, then you would still find a few that would say that no, you know, I know my clients or whatever, something like that. Today, that would sound ridiculous. You wouldn't take them seriously. So our prediction is that the same will happen for hiring. That if you would ask a manager who is scaling their team, you know, what's your tool for doing that? What's the data behind your process, et cetera, that if they would say something vague, that you wouldn't take them seriously. They're just not professional in what they do and haven't figured out that part of their job well enough.
Got it. Got it. So I would love to talk to you for another hours, but another few hours, but obviously this is impossible. So I would like to end this interview with three quick personal questions. So these are questions I'm asking all of my guests. So the first one is, what SaaS companies do you follow up close right now?
I used to have a really good answer, meaning that I used to follow Tableau, the data visualization tool, really closely, both in terms of the product. I was a huge fan, still am, and also in terms of the business. I was just a huge fan of how they sold their product, how they supported their clients, how they built the community around it, how their users or their clients became their evangelists. So I used to be a huge fan of that business. To be honest, I kind of moved away from that field or space a few years ago, so I haven't been following them closely anymore. But a few years back, I that was clearly would have been my answer. Still, my best known experience based on that. I'm modeling my own business now as well, and I can only hope or expect or wish that we will be able to kind of do something similar or even remotely as good, meaning that our users would become as big fans of the product as I saw many Tableau users become. So that's the expectation and something I try to model our own behavior based on.
Okay, I'm curious about it, so I'll check it out. Now, what's your personal tech stack? Not your team's, your personal one. What are the tools you're using?
Just for my own daily life, or what do you mean behind that? So, to be honest, I'm trying to use less and less. So the challenge has been, I used to be a huge geek or to-do list nerd, and I had many tools, you know, how to structure my to-do list and notes and goals and everything. I have over time reduced that down to almost nothing. So to be honest, I have noticed that it became like a task on its own, filling in my to-do list software and managing it and moving things around, trying to find a new one and reading more about effectiveness and doing this and that. So roughly now, my tech stack for my personal things as well as my work things is the calendar, meaning that I just have to figure out what I do with my time. That's all I have. So I have to kind of categorize that, be really thoughtful about how I, you know, bunch the similar things together, when and how I can find time to exercise and, you know, find time to go for a walk with the dog. So that's something I use personally as well a lot. And notes, I guess, yeah. Just a really basic thing where I would store the three things I need to do tomorrow or the seven things I need to accomplish this week. So
So
the
you're going for digital minimalism outside
yes,
of your work.
I think that's the term indeed, and
Yeah.
I'm trying to do that more and more, meaning deleting all the apps on my phone, getting rid of the social media accounts, and doing all that. It just became a bit overwhelming, and I think I
It is. Yeah.
indeed, yes, because I mean, when I work, I have 10 or 12 apps or pieces of software for every piece of the work that I do. So I think I need more space than outside of work to manage all that.
Got it. And finally, what's the latest, most impactful book you've read? Fiction, non-fiction?
That's a good one. Let me think what was the latest one.
Or not the latest, the one that comes to your mind that you like it very much.
It's not a very sophisticated answer, but I would really recommend reading. It was a book by Trevor Noah. Let me find the title. Born a Crime. So Trevor Noah, Born a Crime. Just really light reading, very funny book. So something that I think people need more than yet another book about personal effectiveness or being thoughtful and goal oriented and something.
Yeah,
Read it.
yeah.
I would strongly recommend
Don't read manuals or handbooks before going to sleep. Read
that.
something for fun.
Indeed, yeah, I think that's a much better way to spend your evening.
Yeah. Alon, thank you very much for this insightful conversation. I've been making notes all this time, but for sure I'm gonna re-listen to what you're saying. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure that our listeners will learn great things and they will get great insights on hiring. In general, not only leaders. So, thank you very much and talk to you
Thank you,
next
Victoria.
time.
Thank you for inviting. Thank you for really good questions. Good luck with all the next episodes. I will definitely become a subscriber and a big fan.
Thank you very much, Alo, and thank you all for listening till the end. Wish you a great morning, day, afternoon, or evening. Till next time.